morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Turley, and I represent the appellants in the Adams case. I have the honor of representing a large group of experienced and decorated pilots from around the country. We've detailed their careers, we've detailed what has happened to them in this case. But this is something of an odyssey, of which at least two of the members of this panel have been part of previously. This is the second time that this case has come before the D.C. Court of Appeals. Originally, the case was filed
D.C. Circuit, yes.
The case was originally filed in 2007 in front of Judge Bates under different counsel. And this was a challenge to the original H-60 rule. And the pilots brought that case in order to challenge age discrimination under the rule. Judge Bates decided that the proper course was for the pilots to file with this court, and they did so in 2008. During the pendency of that appeal, Congress finally, frankly, got tired of waiting for the FAA to deal with the age 60 rule, and they effectively rescinded the age 60 rule. They enacted the statute, which is the subject of this case, which said that pilots over age 60 could indeed fly, thereby rejecting the premise of the age 60 rule that there was a threshold risk connected to the age of 60. Since that occurred during the pendency of the appeal, the appellate panel decided that it effectively took away jurisdiction of this court, and in that opinion said, if you want to advance these challenges, you should go back and file again before the district court, which we did. The district court then dismissed these claims, and this is obviously an appeal that has a myriad of different issues where we have limited time. I will simply note that with regard to the APA claims, we have identified what we believe are a series of determinative factual assumptions that the court made. Those inferences should have gone in our favor. But I think it's more valuable, with the court's permission, to address two of the overarching assumptions made by both the district court and by the government in this case that run through the claims. One of those is that there is simply no property interest that is cognizable in the case, and the argument is that that undermines virtually all of the constitutional claims. The second is that there is a rationale here on the basis of the rational basis test. I'd like to first address that property question. The government's argument is that there's simply no property interest that the pilots had under the age, because of the original age 60 rule. And in doing so, we've argued that misunderstands how this section worked, how the age 60 rule applied to senior pilots. There was both present and future value in the seniority of these pilots. It's important to keep in mind that these pilots were some of them not only the most experienced but most storied pilots in their industry. The loss of these benefits constituted hundreds of thousands of dollars for some of these pilots. Now, where I disagree with my esteemed counsel from the FAA is that it ignores how the actual industry works with regard to seniority. Seniority in the airline industry represents a negotiable and valuable asset. It's an employment asset that works in many ways like stock. That is, your seniority number is that it actually moves with you in your employment, and it gives you an interest in the airline. It is sort of like a share in the airline. Moreover, it is not true that under the prior age 60 rule, these pilots did not have a property interest. To the contrary, under the original age 60 rule, the reason we came before you last time is that there were exceptions under that rule. And in fact, pilots were allowed to fly under that rule past age 60. We were actually arguing that they were applying those exceptions in an arbitrary way. Let me give you an example to understand that property interest. under the previous age 60 rule, a pilot could continue to fly under different parts. What the Experienced Pilot Act does is it bars them from flying at all unless they give up their seniority, give up their position, and essentially apply for new hires. Under the old rule, that the old rule applied to what was called Part 121, which is the commercial aircraft that is the focus of much of our discussion. But there are other parts in which pilots were allowed to fly. And one such part was Part 135, which were the same exact aircraft that were often being used for support or maintenance. And many of these pilots, not many, but some of these pilots were allowed to be Part 135 pilots. There's also Part 91, which is for private aircraft.
Let me just ask you that if I had been a Part 121 pilot and I reached age 60, did I not have to get another job with the carrier, namely as a pilot who was flying Part 135?
Thank you, Your Honor. It's an excellent question. The answer is that some of these carriers just simply transferred that pilot within the corporate structure.
But it was the carrier's decision to put them in a new position is what I'm trying to get at.
Yes, but the avenue for reassignment allowed them to retain the value of their seniority. Also, many...
What I'm thinking of, yes, Your Honor. You're probably more familiar than I, in the age discrimination case that went to the Supreme Court, the reference to the fact that pilots transferred into other positions in anticipation of reaching age 60. So this was something that was what I'll call a known modus operandi in the airline industry among pilots, among experienced pilots.
I would differ in this sense, Your Honor, with that view, and that is this was a unique situation where under age 60, under the original age 60 rule, it's true, it was a forced retirement program, but airlines had, and the FAA had the ability to mitigate that, and some pilots took advantage of that. For example, pilots were allowed to continue to fly the very same aircraft on foreign carriers. They were allowed to fly under different parts. In some cases, they were simply given a different title and allowed to fly. What happened with this statute is that it wiped all that out. So these pilots had an expectation. In fact, they were trying to litigate that expectation. And then the statute came in and wiped it out. The reason they wiped it out is because of these two provisions that we can call E1 and E2, E1 being the non-retroactivity provision, E2 being the protection for compliance. Those were written by the ELPA union. And ELPA publicly said that they drafted it, took credit for putting it in to legislation, and it was there to protect younger pilots. And so what we've argued here is that the district court made a fundamental error. We didn't have a hearing in this case, and the court, and Judge Kennedy left the court soon after making his ruling. But the court made a fundamental error in saying that there was no property interest. And what we've argued is that there's a long line of cases actually recognizing this type of property interest in employment benefits. But what was also troubling was the rationales that were used by the district court. And I say rationales because my clients have been faced with a sort of shifting sand problem since this whole thing began. Whenever they have shown, for example, the age 60 rule was invalid and Congress agreed that they were right all along, that at 60 there's no reason you shouldn't fly. I mean, that's what the law says. There's no threshold danger to flying at 60. And so when they came back, the government said, well, you know, the reason we're going to require the new age limitation is because of two reasons. One is what the government calls the safety rationale. And the government argues that seniority stripping and the protection for compliance somehow advances the interests of safety. I will simply note that there is absolutely no rational connection between stripping someone of their seniority and the safety of flying. In fact, the whole premise of the bill, of the new legislation.
Sorry, you shift back and forth. Mm-hmm. They were able to maintain seniority as long as they did not fall within the type of flying that was prohibited after age 60, right?
Some pilots were able to retain their seniority, yes, Your Honor.
Right. So, I'm just looking at your opening brief. It seems to be completely different from the position you're taking now. You say there at page 33, the pilots had a legitimate expectation in the prior litigation that they would be allowed to return to their prior positions. I've never heard that as a basis for finding an entitlement or a property interest.
Your Honor, we made both arguments. The argument that you're referencing is that the pilots believe that under the previous rule and the exceptions recognized by the FAA, that they were entitled to the exceptions under that provision. They also believed that the other part of the age 60 rule, which is the age limit itself, was unconstitutional. That is, they believed that as Congress agreed, that age 60 really had no relevance. In fact, the FAA administrator herself at the time, when we were in this court, said the age 60 rule is without foundation, and she thought it had to be changed. So what we were arguing, Your Honor, is that there were some pilots that were able to get these exceptions, but they also believed that the overall threshold age limitation could not be sustained on discrimination grounds. And what the government came in with is no longer defending the age 60 rule as based on some type of data or research, because it's not. And Congress reflected that. They said, well, you know, the new restriction that strips them of their seniority makes flying safer. And what we're saying is I can't imagine, and perhaps the court can imagine, a reason why stripping someone of seniority advances safety. The second rationale that they put forward is that this protects against disharmony. And the idea there is that by stripping them of their seniority, we achieve harmony within the ranks. What we have submitted to this court is this is a rather perverse way of achieving harmony. That is, you achieve harmony by effectively shooting half the people with interests. And
shooting, you say shooting, but you use that to refer to denying them a release from the prior rule that applied to them.
Actually, it's not the prior rule, Your Honor, because under the prior rule, there were exceptions where you could fly under some other parts. But more importantly, the problem with the disharmony argument is that, and forgive me for my vivid verbiage, the problem with the disharmony claim is that any time you discriminate against one group in favor of another group, you can say you achieved harmony by simply eliminating the claims of those individuals. And what we've pointed out is that this really isn't any view of harmony that we're familiar with. It's a very dangerous notion to say that achieves harmony and that can be a rational basis. But we also know that this is part of the problem. There's sort of a Jackson Pollock approach to the rationales here, because the judge also, later in dealing with the takings claim, came up with a wholly different rationale. And the judge said, and this is on page 79 of the district court opinion, when choosing to raise the age limit, Congress had to choose one group of pilots, active or senior, to bear the costs of the resulting increase in commercial pilots. So the court said, basically, Congress had to choose who's going to bear the cost here, and basically, you're it. You're the senior pilots. You'll bear the costs. That's not a harmony factor, and it's not a safety factor. What's interesting is that the court went ahead and said, but this still isn't a takings, even though the court said they're shifting these costs to you.
Going back to your argument that this is a viable property interest, if I understand what you're saying, you're arguing that even though these pilots could, before the law extending the age, could have been in some other
part, 135 or 91 or whatever, and they would have retained their seniority. And now you're saying that even if they were in that other part, they lost their seniority? That I didn't understand that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, if I was unclear. So under the original rule, a small number of pilots were able to retain their seniority by going to a different part. That is no longer possible under the new law. And our point is only this. We did challenge the age 60 rule because we felt that the age 60 was discriminatory without foundation, something that the Congress essentially affirmed. But
no, actually, Congress didn't affirm that. Congress changed the ceiling. It made no ruling on the constitutional issue you were raising.
No, Your Honor, I didn't mean to suggest that, Congress made a ruling on our constitutional issue. What I'm saying is that Congress ruled that pilots that reach the age 60 can continue to fly. They found that there wouldn't be any age barrier to flying, no sense of risk. And that, in our view, can only be read one way. They allowed pilots from age 60 to fly. The only thing that they did at ELPA's demand was to strip senior pilots of their seniority in favor of ELPA members. And what we've argued here is that
you seem to shift between seniority under the old rules, which was preserved in non-121 flying, in non-121 flying, and as far as I can make out, still is, right? How is seniority, insofar as the pilot moves from 121 to other forms, how is that seniority jeopardized by the statute?
The interpretation by the industry and the FAA is that this age criteria now applies to all pilots and in these aircraft. And so the view, at least in the industry, is that it does forestall those other areas. But ultimately, you know, we can get lost in the weeds. If I could just finish the answer, I know I'm out of time. I've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Where is it that
you make that argument?
Well, it's actually in our brief, I can cite to the page on my rebuttal, but the FTEPA itself makes no distinction between these parts. It actually establishes an age limit. And if you take a look at E1, it refers to any person who is flying under this section. But the view of the industry is that this forestalls the earlier avenues. But one of the things that I wanted to emphasize is that really, in terms of getting into the weeds between Part 135, 121, what we're arguing here is that the court should have heard these claims, that these are factual disputes that there should be a record on, that we should have the ability to present to the court. We argue that they were closed off from having these opportunities, but we were never given the opportunity to establish the record for the court. The court simply made a factual assumption, that went against our clients.
What exactly is the assumption that you question?
Well, there's a number of assumptions that relate to this, but one is that the court assumed that there was no property interest because effectively these pilots had no expectation to retain their seniority in these airlines. And we argued that's actually not true. It's a rather complex system, but some of the pilots could have retained their seniority. We were arguing in this court for the type of exception that would allow them to do that. But there's also an assumption that the court makes, which is equally untrue, and the court assumes that older pilots can be effectively rehired. And one of the things that we argued is that virtually no senior pilots have been rehired because of the way this industry works. And we wanted to present to the court why this was a very clever decision by ELPA. That is, they knew that if you return senior pilots to new hire status, there would be no practical way that one of our senior pilots could ever get back in the cockpit of a 777. It would just never happen because of how the industry is structured. We were never given a chance to show that because we were dismissed early in this process.
Is there anything that in the district court opinion that assumes the contrary?
Yes, I believe there is. But if you look at the district court opinions generally on the lack of a property interest, which the government has picked up, the whole basis of that is the court said you had no expectation of seniority or these benefits because they were wiped out under the age 60 rule. That permeates the entire opinion, and we believe that's a flawed understanding.
So I just need to be clear on this, and Judge Brown was asking the question. Your claim is not limited to that, and I don't know what you call these planes, triple something planes?
Well, that's just one of the larger planes, the 777, yeah, 777.
Your claim is not simply that your clients had the expectation that they could continue after age 60 to fly 777 planes, but that they could transfer into other jobs. And now you're saying the district courts failed to, I just need to be clear, I thought the original point was since Congress passed this act acknowledging that pilots can fly until 65, therefore we, the plaintiffs, ought to get our 777 jobs back. There's no basis for keeping us out of those jobs. And these rationales that have been offered, you say, just don't stand up under scrutiny. But now I hear something else, and that is that if I had been a pilot and I turned 60 and I was flying AAA planes, but then I went to Part 135, or I went to Part 91. I could continue, for some purposes, to fly 777 planes, but for other new jobs, I would be doing other types of work for the carrier. But I would still have my seniority, in the sense of length of years I had worked for the carrier, and that type of thing. And now you're saying, no, that this act wipes out even the latter.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the reason this can get confusing is because we essentially have two age rules that are interacting. Under the original age 60 rule, we did challenge that on discrimination grounds and said 60 has no basis. But we also have argued when the court looked at the original age 60 rule and said, you'd never had a liberty interest back then because the age 60 rule was upheld and you couldn't have gotten back to your jobs. One of the things that we argued in response to that is that's actually not true, that some of the pilots affected by the original age 60 rule were able to fly. We also noted that in 2007, when Congress finally
able to continue to fly 777.
Well, to fly planes under those parts, not just 777. I give the 777 example because it's a large commercial aircraft. And part of the cleverness of ALPA on this is that they knew most of these senior pilots, some of whom are here today, were pilots of major commercial aircraft. And ALPA knew that if you force them to go back to the front of the back of the line, there is no way, the way the industry works, that they will ever see the inside of the planes that they were in. In fact, there's no way they'd be hired. And in fact, they haven't been hired. And so we emphasize that. The other point that we made is also that in 2007, you have Congress coming in and saying, okay, you can fly at 60. And this was consistent with the international rule. And one of the things that we argued at district court is we certainly in 2007 and before, we had an expectation that this rule would be struck down or changed by Congress, even the FAA administrator.
I think that's not a promising taking argument or due process argument.
Well, Your Honor,
you were litigating and you hoped to win, that gave you a property interest in what would have happened if you had won.
And we were litigating, Your Honor. We were in this court.
I understand that.
And the reason that we were not able to bring that to conclusion was because Congress stepped in and said pilots can fly at age 60, and that we're now consistent with the international rule. And what these pilots are arguing with these other issues dealing with Part 135 and 91, and also with regard to the enactment itself, is that they did have an expectation of future value to these employment plans. And we tried to get the district court to allow us to show how seniority works in the airline industry.
Just let me be clear. Of the plaintiffs in this case, is anyone a Part 135 or 190 or 91?
I believe a couple of our pilots have flown under those parts, but most have not. The number that have gone under 135 and 91 is a small number relatively of these pilots.
Okay, I just need to be clear what's before us. That's why I'm trying to.
Yes, no, I'm sorry if I've confused you, and believe me, sometimes.
I thought all of these pilots were no longer working because they were over 60.
A couple of the pilots were able to secure positions. I think we have footnotes to that. But the vast majority, the vast majority of pilots were 121 pilots, and they were put outside the fence. And they challenged that decision and were in court when the law changed. I see my time I'd like to retain 5 minutes. I'm afraid
just let me just be clear on one other thing, too, that to the extent your expectation is that if the rule was struck, then they could continue to fly the 777 planes. And I'm not clear how, if the age 60 rule is in effect, the fact that there were exceptions under the age 60 rule carries forward in an expectation once Congress has abolished the age 60 rule.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that we're together all the way up to the end of that, in the sense that the only relevance to these parts that allowed for exceptions was in response to the district court's assumption that there was no expectations of senior pilots under the age 60 rule. And how we responded was, even putting aside the future value of the seniority, there was current value in that there were exceptions even under the 860 rule. So when Congress swooped in with this law and put in these ALPA provisions, it did extinguish a property interest. But the reason the record is so thin, Your Honor, is because of the case being dismissed. What we argued in front of the district court was, we can prove these things. Here's how seniority works. Here's how it affected these pilots. We were never given that chance. And what we raise in our briefs is that these are credible and documented arguments. We could have proven it, but more importantly, the inferences of those factual arguments should be read in favor of the non-moving party.
I just want to recall that you have promised on rebuttal to call my attention to the passage in your blue brief where you identify the entitlements that antedated this legislation and were cut out by it.
Well, Your Honor, my point was that the statute itself does not refer to these parts. That is the...
Wherever it is, either in the interpretation of the statute or in the statute, What is it that cut out pre-existing entitlements?
Yes.
And I don't include in that hopes of a successful equal protection case.
Yes, Your Honor, I will address that on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Edward Himmelfarb for the United States and the other federal respondents. I should probably talk a little bit about the rationale for the statute just to start out. Now, 5 years ago, when Congress increased to age 65, the age at which Part 121 pilots had to stop flying, it had to consider what to do with thousands of pilots aged 60 to 64 who had already been forced to stop flying in Part 121 by virtue of the age 60 rule. So the question was for Congress was, you know, what do we do? Do we bring back potentially thousands of pilots over age 60 when the entire workforce of Part 121 pilots was in total about 80,000? That's really, our estimate is about 9,000 of these over 60 pilots, roughly, give or take a little bit. And so we're talking about over 10% of the workforce. Congress would have to consider whether They should do that and potentially interfere with everyone's expectations of seniority within the existing workforce? Or should it tell these over 60 pilots, you know, you're already out, you're not flying Part 121 anymore, and we're going to keep you out? Or should it tell them, you can come back, but you can't affect everyone else's seniority? And that's basically the compromise that Congress enacted. Now, we understand, as a result of this compromise, the over 60 pilots are very unhappy. And nobody blames them for being unhappy. Nobody blames them. The question here is a legal question. Did Congress do anything unconstitutional when it enacted this compromise? And the answer is, it did not. Now, I think I also want to...
Counsel, do you understand the argument that we've heard just recently, that there were seniority issues not dependent on flying 121, flying under 121, that have been reduced, either eliminated, either by the statute or its interpretation?
Well, no, Your Honor. First thing is, that's not what the complaint alleges at all. The complaint alleges, if you look at each of the allegations with respect to individual pilot plaintiffs here, each one says, as a result of the age 60 rule, this pilot lost seniority status, benefits, and salary rates. And that's our position, too. The age 60 rule forced these plaintiff pilots to leave. They were no longer allowed to fly under Part 121.
That allegation in the complaint is broad enough to capture this broader argument. I thought Judge Williams' question was getting at, has it ever been made in this more refined way? In other words, when I first looked at the case, I thought it was these plaintiffs were seeking to get continued flying Part 121 with seniority.
Well, that's what I thought too.
All right.
And I still think that. I mean, I'm not sure I understand I'm not sure I understand Professor Turley's argument. The argument is that they're no longer allowed to fly in other parts under the statute? Yes. Because I think that's not correct.
The argument that seems to have emerged here is that they can, just as they could before, but with less seniority than they could before.
They can. The statute says they can fly Part 121 again, but if they relinquish this, whatever seniority they might have had.
I
understand that, but the argument that appears to be being made is that their entitlement to fly under other parts with seniority, rights pre-existing the statute, have been eliminated.
I don't see how you could possibly read the statute that way, Your Honor. The statute says that it talks about covered operations and is limited to Part 121. It doesn't affect what they can do under other parts.
So your position would be, if they applied for work to fly under Part 91 or 135 or whatever, the provisions of this particular act would not affect that?
That's correct. That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
And that's even if they're 62?
That's correct. They're allowed to fly over age 60 in other parts.
No, what I meant was, that's even if at age 60 they were subject to the age 60 rule.
That's right, because what the age 60 rule did was it said they could no longer fly under Part 121. And as Professor Turley did say, pilots in the old regime under age 60 did sometimes move into other parts. And that was perfectly permissible.
And continues permissible.
Continues to be permissible because the statute says covered operations, and that's defined to mean Part 121.
That's how I came to this case, but I thought what I heard this morning was, because this was dismissed without an opportunity to present evidence to demonstrate why there were these expectations, therefore, the district court didn't give them the benefit of the reasonable inferences.
Well, the expectations, as I understand it, maybe I'm still confused by this, but the expectations that I think we're speaking about were expectations of flying under other parts, and that's not affected by the statute. So I'm not quite sure how that's relevant here. Maybe I'm just not quite understanding his argument properly.
Well, I heard him say that the carriers are interpreting the act to apply across the board.
I'm sorry?
I understood him to say the carriers were interpreting the act to apply across the board so that pilots who might have had an expectation to be able to continue to fly with seniority in Part 135 or Part 91 no longer are able to do so under the interpretation the carriers have placed on the act. And that's why I asked him, well, who are the plaintiffs here?
I don't think I understand it that way. Again, I could be confused about that. I don't understand the argument that way.
And just so I understand, yeah, that's not the argument you have understood them to be presenting. Is that what you mean?
No, I understand them to be complaining that they can't come back under Part 121 with full seniority.
Right.
And that's their basic argument against the statute. Couple of quick points here, unless the court has specific questions about our arguments. A couple of quick points about Professor Turley's argument. As the Seventh Circuit's decision said in Yetman, the FAA has never granted exemptions from, never did grant exceptions to the age 60 rule. There was one incident in which they applied it to Part 135 commuter airlines, and some of those pilots, because the age 60 rule didn't apply at the time, were actually over 60 at the time, and they had a grandfathering in of those pilots. But that's the only time. Individual applications for exceptions.
Well, that may be the only time, based on the evidence before the Seventh Circuit. What I heard appellant's counsel to be saying is that they're prepared to put on evidence to show that there were lots of exceptions, and I do remember that reference in one of his briefs.
Right. Well, we checked with the FAA, Your Honor, and
okay.
The FAA...
I am not disputing the accuracy of your representation. I am simply saying that because there was no fact-finding in this case, is the counsel's argument, this court doesn't know what the truth is, and that makes a difference as to whether they had a property interest.
Well, I think the thing about the property interest is, let's just take the broader issue about the property interest. This court said in the Hedinga decision that you don't have a property or a liberty interest in the regulatory status quo. As the court is aware, the aviation industry is an extremely highly regulated area, and Congress can change the rules in the middle of the game without affecting people's property interests or without affecting them in a constitutionally deficient way.
Before we get to that issue, I understand your argument to be that there's simply no change from either the statute or its interpretation with respect to whatever non-121 provisions may have existed.
That's right. There's no change. The statute does not change that.
So it could be classified as a magnificent entitlement and still would not change the outcome.
If I understand the question, Your Honor,
there's no change in it.
That's right. There's no change under the statute to the way the other parts operate. Professor Turley said that that we claim that Congress's rationale for increasing as he says, stripping the seniority, which I think is not an accurate representation of the statute, that Congress's rationale was safety. We did not make that argument. We said that the increase in the age was safety related. The provision, the non-retroactivity provision that said that over 60-year-old pilots can come back and fly under Part 121 without seniority was not based on safety. It was based on labor management kind of principles. You know, it's the idea that Congress and the federal government has an independent interest in workplace harmony in the aviation industry, which is regulated. It's regulated the labor management relations in the aviation industry since 1936, roughly 75 years. Congress has sometimes stepped in and not left these decisions to the air carriers and the employees of the air carriers. Congress has stepped in, for example, the same month in which the Fair Treatment for Experienced Pilots Act was enacted, December 2007, Congress passed something called the McCaskill-Bond Amendment, the two senators from Missouri, McCaskill and Bond. And what this does is it says when two air carriers merge and they have to mix their seniority lists, it has to be done in a fair and equitable way. So instead of just leaving it to the industry, to the air carriers and their unionized employees, Congress said, here is the basic outline of how you're supposed to do it. Here are some procedures about how you do it. So there's certainly more than adequate precedent for Congress stepping in to make these decisions.
Counsel, back on our earlier point, do you have appellant's brief, the blue brief?
Yes, I do.
Turn to page 36, if you would. This is where appellant is citing to the complaint, talking about how the application of the age 60 rule varied significantly over the decades, such that there would be these expectations, and that prior to 1995, he says, the FAA routinely granted exemptions to the age 60 rule and allowed a class of approximately 200 pilots to continue joining the exemption for 4 years after, et cetera.
I think he's referring to the Part 135 pilots that I described earlier. If you look at, I think it's the Yetman case, they talk about that. It could be this court's decision, Professional Pilots Federation. I'm not quite sure which decision. One of them talks about the situation that the FAA addressed when it applied the age 60 rule to Part 135 commuter pilots. And that's where that number comes from. That's a kind of unique situation.
Outside the effect of this statute, right?
Yes. Yes, it's outside the effects of the statute. I mean, in the sense that those pilots, once that rule change was applied to Part 135 commuter pilots, they were in the same boat as 121 pilots, so they were required to leave at the end of when they turned 60 also. But apart from that, it's not covered by the statute.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Oh, I'm sorry, I get it. The Part 135 pilots who were covered by that rule change in 1995, around 1995, from that time that rule was passed, they had to leave at the age 60, just like Part 121 pilots. But the statute applies to Part 121 pilots.
I don't understand, just so I'm clear on this, why all this is in the brief if it's not part of the case. He's arguing that under the age 60
yes.
rule,
mm-hmm.
the FAA, for example, in 1995, had allowed an exception. And you tell me it's the Part 135 pilots.
Yes.
And as I understand the argument, it's that if I'm age 59 and working when the age 60 rule was in place, I had an expectation that if I could get a position in as a Part 135 pilot, I could continue working past age 60 and I would have all my benefits and all my seniority. Now the Act has come along and taken all that away. So the notion that, this is the argument as I understand it, is that if the district court says I had no expectation of being able to work beyond age 60 with full benefits, that is just incorrect as a matter of fact.
No, I think what the district court said is you had no expectation of working as a Part 121 pilot
All
past
right.
age 60. If the court has no further questions.
I wanted to ask one question. I think, and forgive me, but didn't the government argue that it thought the district court was wrong in one of its constitutional, in part of one of its constitutional rulings? Am I incorrect in that?
I don't think so. What we said was that the district court had one rationale for dismissing the APA claim and that there were two better ones. The district court was correct about it, but there were two even better reasons to dismiss the APA claims, mootness and the fact that the challenged answer that the FAA gave and withdrew 4.5 years ago didn't even apply to them.
All right. Anything further?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right. Counsel for appellants.
Thank you. I'd like to first address the task that was given to me by Judge Williams. I do think that to some extent we're talking past each other, my esteemed counsel and I.
I just want to know what you claimed.
Yes. To recap, and I'll point to where in the brief and in the opinion we're talking about. The reason we raised Part 135 and Part 91 deals with the district court's sweeping statement that these pilots had no property interest at all because of the operation of Age 61. And you can take a look at page 9 of the district court opinion for one such reference. They appear actually repeatedly in the opinion, where the district court says that plaintiffs had no legitimate reason to believe they would be allowed to fly after their 60th birthdays at all, let alone with full seniority and benefits.
And we're not to read that in terms of the allegations in the complaint that they wanted to fly as Part 121. And that's all that was before the district court.
No, Your Honor, that when we deal with whether we have a property interest, yeah. The district court, to support the statement, had to say that these pilots had no economic value, no expectations at all to continue to fly after age 60.
As Part 121. They may have other expectations and other jobs.
Actually, one of the things that we argue in our complaint is that the effect of this law has been that no senior pilots have been rehired. And we wanted to show through discovery, through the case, that the way this industry is structured, this effectively bars a senior pilot from resuming flights. In terms of 135.
I just noticed that in the table of contents for your blue brief, you cite Part 121, but you never cite Part 135, Part 91. I mean, if you've raised this issue, it's really subtle.
Well, we raise it specifically, Your Honor, on page 15, for example, on the reply brief, we talk about this.
The reply brief is a little late.
Well, the reason it was in response to the government's argument that there was no property interest. This, once again, this doesn't necessarily go to the heart of our claims. What this goes only to our argument that there's a variety of property interests involved, current and future. And one of the things that we raised is that these pilots did have expectations, even under age 60. The only reason we cite to this part is as an example of the type of factual assertion that
it
was
to be relevant. It has to be relevant to some claim. And unless you're making a claim that the statute had some adverse impact on their entitlements outside the 121 realm, it's irrelevant.
We do claim that, Your Honor. In the complaint, we say that these pilots have not been rehired and cannot be rehired because of the way this industry is structured. And we repeatedly refer to the fact that these pilots cannot get any employment after 135. We argue that that was the whole reason the ELPA provisions were drafted the way they were, and they have succeeded. But the reason the record is thin is because we made that argument, but we weren't allowed to go to hearing. We weren't allowed to establish it.
You have to have an allegation that makes it relevant.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the allegation that hundreds of the most senior and decorated pilots have not been able to be rehired under any part is our argument about the effect of this law. And 135 is just an example that we gave to show that it's not all future economic interest. The whole premise of our briefs is that the district court didn't consider this as an employment value, that this is a real employment value in terms of seniority in the way that this industry is structured, that they had future expectations, and that they had current expectations. And the example I would give of that definition, Your Honor, is your own decision in George Washington University versus District of Columbia, Judge Williams, where you address what is often referred to as a new property approach of how to define a property interest. And what that opinion does, in my view, correctly so, is it sets a threshold of what will constitute a property interest for the purposes of a case of this kind. What we're saying is that all of these different expectations satisfy the standard that you articulated in George Washington University versus District of Columbia. I'm out of time. I'd love to address a couple points that my opposing counsel raised.
Very quickly.
Okay. I know I've used a lot of your time already. When my esteemed counsel, I don't want to get lost on 135 because it really was part of the response to liberty, to the property interest, but I'll simply note that if you take a look at the complaint, we quote the section on page 81. This is paragraph 230. And that actually deals generally with exceptions. It's not limited to Part 135. It talks about the exceptions that the FAA can simply grant. And that was why we were before this court before. We were trying to show the arbitrary nature in which these exceptions were granted. So I have to respectfully disagree with my friend and colleague, Mr. Himmelfarb. But the one thing I want to emphasize here is that the reason we're raising these things is because these were going to be part of our showing to the court of real current and future value. And we believe that in terms of the complaint, we have satisfied the standard. These are not speculative. They're not spurious. These are efforts to get the court to consider how this industry functions and why the ELPA provisions were written the way they were. They had the result that they intended. Your Honor, in closing, I simply ask this court to consider. My clients have been back and forth from the district court to the Court of Appeals trying to have a chance to prove their case. Their livelihoods were wiped out, and we can certainly discuss to what extent or what the value was. But what they're seeking here is something very, very basic. They'd like the opportunity to prove it, to show how it was that they lost the value of their livelihoods and their careers. Thank you very much.
We will take the case under advisement.